This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the U.S. Senate voted down a bill that would have approved the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. The proposed pipeline would transport crude oil from Alberta, Canada, picking up U.S. oil in Montana, and taking it through the U.S. down to ports in Texas. The president has delayed construction of the pipeline while a review is conducted. The Senate vote to approve construction was defeated by a single vote. Senator Bernie Sanders was among those who voted no on the bill. He said the legislation moved in the wrong direction towards more dependence on fossil fuel, and he characterized it as, quote, insane. Senator Sanders is also standing behind President Obama's executive action on immigration, and he's working to improve mental health care for veterans. We're going to talk with him about those and other national concerns today as he joins me in the studio for the full hour. Senator Sanders, nice to have you back.
Great to be with you.
You characterized the Keystone XL pipeline bill as moving us in the wrong direction when it comes to fossil fuel dependence. There's already a pipeline that transports oil from Alberta, Canada, through the U.S. to Texas. This particular pipeline is of a larger diameter. It's a shorter route. It would directly pick up some of the oil from the Bakken Shale in Montana and North Dakota. But why is this particular pipeline more of a problem?
Well, I didn't say it's more or less of a problem, but what the scientific community is telling us, Jane, and there's no debate about this, except perhaps on Fox TV, but among the scientific community, climate change is real. It is an enormously serious global problem. It is already causing devastating issues in the United States and around the world in terms of floods and droughts and extreme weather disturbances. And we have a short window of opportunity, perhaps, to reverse climate change. Now, if that is the reality, why in God's name would we facilitate, make it easier for some of the dirtiest oil in the world to be excavated? And that is the issue to me. My Republican friends talk about this being a jobs program. It is true. There will be some construction jobs, but there'll be 35 permanent jobs. That's not a jobs program. To my mind, if we are serious about saving the planet for our kids and our grandchildren, we have to reverse climate change, which means move aggressively to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, not bring forth some of the dirtiest oil in the world.
The Bakken region that I mentioned in Montana and North Dakota, and it's a little bit up in Canada as well, it's already producing oil faster than it can ship it out. And some of that oil is being transported on trains. There have been some real safety concerns about transporting that on trains. That derailment in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, was carrying Bakken oil. How do you propose that oil gets out of the region, or do you think there should be some rule to prevent them? I mean, they're burning oil right now.
Right. I would hope that that is one of the arguments that we are hearing is, hey, look, this is inevitable. This oil is going to get to the Gulf Coast anyhow. I'm not so sure that that is the case. I think we have many friends in Canada who are not sympathetic to this. You got a lot of native tribes there whose land a proposed pipeline would have to go through, who are not sympathetic to that. But the bottom line is, I think we lose as a nation our credibility when we talk about the dangers of climate change by approving this pipeline. So I think the vote that I cast was the right vote. I'm sure the Republicans will bring this up when they control the Senate. I hope very much that the president will veto it if they have the votes, and I think they will have the votes in the new Congress, and I hope very much that we can sustain that veto.
Specifically on the oil that is being produced in the Bakken Shale region, you know, regardless of whether the Keystone XL pipeline goes through or not, do you think there needs to be or can be some sort of government regulation there? I mean, it's, as we all know, been an oil boom. They're producing it faster. They can ship it out. Do you think there needs to be something other than the free market at work there?
Again, when the scientific community tells us that the future of the planet depends on our transforming our energy system, do I think that the United States government, the Canadian government, and the international community should be very, very aggressive in breaking our dependence on fossil fuels? To say the least, I certainly do. When I use the word insane, that's a strong word. But I'm just sitting here thinking, as somebody who has 4 kids and 7 grandchildren, what these young people will tell us in 30 or 40 years when the world is experiencing droughts and floods and extreme weather disturbances, and they say, the scientists were clear. What did you do about it? Oh, we voted for the transporting of some of the dirtiest oil in the world. So
Before I let it go, then, specifically on domestic oil production, do you think there needs to be action by the government?
Yes.
What?
Well, what I think there needs to be is obviously if oil is – if you're talking about the transportation of oil.
Production. It's getting out.
I think we need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel. There was a piece yesterday in the New York Times talking about how wind and solar – the prices of wind and solar are plummeting. If we were aggressive as a nation in investing in new technology and in supporting wind and solar and heat pumps and geothermal – we can transform our energy system, and I believe that's what we have to do.
We're talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders. If you have a question for him about energy policy, how he feels about President Obama's executive action on immigration, or what the senator is doing to try to prevent military suicides, you can call now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments, your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We have a couple of questions from listeners who want to square your opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline with a position on the domestic natural gas pipeline that's been proposed to go through Addison County underneath the lake to International Paper in Fort Ticonderoga and then eventually down to Rutland. Mary in Cornwall says Senator Sanders has come out strongly against the Keystone XL pipeline. Why has he been silent on the Vermont Gas Metro pipe? We need him to make a public stand against this project. Will he do it? And Mark says about both of those projects, both are meant to transport potentially hazardous material to distant points for commercial interests with limited usefulness to the areas through which the pipelines pass. Both are going to reduce the value of the properties they pass through as well, and both are highly politicized issues that have spawned grassroots protests. Does the senator support the Addison Project in Vermont?
Well, it's, you know, I voted on the Keystone Pipeline, and that's an issue that I have been heavily involved in. To a large degree, the issue of the pipeline going through Addison County is a state issue. I think the debate is a difficult debate. The argument on one hand is that substituting natural gas for oil will cut greenhouse gas emissions. On the other side, there is a rational argument that says that if we invested in things like sustainable energy or even heat pumps, that we're spending, I think it was $135 million on, that's a lot of money. Can that money be spent in a better way? And that's a reasonable argument, but I'm going to apologize to the folks involved in that and saying that I have not studied that as much as I have the Keystone.
You have taken issues on other stands on issues on other state issues like the F-35. People have been pressuring you to take stands on state issues that also involve some national interests. Is this one that you just?
It's one that, I think there is an argument to be made on both sides. I have not really, to be honest with you, studied it as thoroughly as I should. So I'm going to back off on a major decision here.
Let's talk a little bit about immigration. Last week, the president announced that he would be taking executive action on immigration in the absence of any congressional action. His plan could shield as many as half of the estimated 11 million undocumented people in this country from deportation on a temporary basis. You supported his plan. What aspects of it are you particularly in favor of?
Well, Jane, let's back that up for a second and say this. I am not happy that the president is forced to use an executive action. I think if the president were here, he would tell you that legislation for 10 different reasons is the superior way to go. It's long term. It's not a 3-year thing. Next president can change it. The frustration that we have here is about a year and a half ago, the United States Senate, with my vote, in a bipartisan way, by the way, passed fairly good, comprehensive immigration legislation dealing with a very serious problem in this country. You've described to some degree what the problem is. Republicans in the House have refused to do anything. And this is part impossible. I don't mean to be terribly partisan here, but the truth of the matter is this country faces major, major problems. And we have a Republican House that has refused to address minimum wage, jobs issue, climate change, immigration, pay equity, you name the issue. And the president finally said, look, you guys are not doing anything. It's an issue we have to deal with. I'm going to take executive action. What he has also said, which I agree, is if you do something, I'll rescind the executive action. I want you to do something, but I can't stand here another year, another 2 years, and not take some action. So it is a step forward. I hope very much that it – prompts our Republican friends to say, let's start debating this issue in the Congress and let's pass something.
Were there areas where you wish the president had gone farther?
I think what he did is, remember, this was an executive action, and I think he was felt limited by what he could do. But the fact is that if you have a young person born in the United States of America who is an American citizen and his or her parent walks out the door and can be arrested and deported, I think that does not make a whole lot of sense to most Americans, and I support the president on that.
The president has mentioned, other politicians have also mentioned, that the U.S. policy as it stood before this executive action couldn't be enforced. The government cannot deport all of the people that it says.
Well, I think that is the case. I think that we can't and we wouldn't. Imagine what the resources, what it would say to the world to deport, what, 11 million people. I don't think that that's going to happen. And I think the point that the president was making is he's more interested in seeing the enforcement agents try to take on people who are committing crimes, protecting the border, and focusing on real security issues rather than deporting people who have not committed, you know, any crimes, who are working at a job and separating them from their kids.
As you mentioned, the president has basically said, show me a bill. Show me a bill. I will rescind this action. His plan is a temporary one. It only offers a reprieve for a few years for the possibility of deportation for the people who are eligible. His successor could repeal it and move in a different direction. Do you expect to see any legislation come through in Congress either before January or after the new Congress is seated?
Well, I don't think we'll see anything before January in the lame duck session. But I hope, you know, the Republican Party is involved in a very significant debate. And I think you have some Republicans who say, look, we can't ignore this issue. We can't ignore the Hispanic community. We've got to do something. And then you have some others who are demagoguing the issue, who are very fierce and not wanting the Congress to do anything. How that plays out, we will see.
But there seems like there is some room for bipartisan action, given that this is an issue that crosses party lines.
There is room for bipartisan action on every issue. You know, I'm trying to do my best to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Mitt Romney, the former Republican candidate for president, wants to raise the minimum wage. Will we have any support from Republicans in the Congress to do that? Maybe, maybe not. Jobs program. Yesterday, you may have seen on 60 Minutes, they talked about infrastructure, crumbling infrastructure in America. We need to invest $3 trillion rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. If you spend $1 trillion, you create 13 million jobs. I can tell you there are some Republicans who do understand the issue. Can we get bipartisan support? I hope so. On the other hand, you have some Republicans who, you know, their job in life, it appears to be, is to give more tax breaks to the rich and cut every program imaginable. Can we reach a bipartisan agreement? I would hope so.
You just mentioned infrastructure, and I want to double back to a note that we got from Donna in South Burlington, who's wondering if you might vote to approve the Keystone Pipeline if it was attached to a gasoline tax increase to fund bridge construction and repair around the country. Donna says, I'm not a proponent of the pipeline, but if the House and Senate can compromise in a way that really brings jobs to rebuild much-needed infrastructure, like bridges and an improved electrical grid, Donna says, I'd say it would be worth it.
I would respectfully disagree with Donna. I am working as hard as anybody to find the money that we need to rebuild our roads and our bridges, our airports, our water systems, wastewater plants, rail systems way behind many other countries around the world. And not only will that effort make this country more efficient and productive, it will create a significant number of jobs. Again, we spent $3 trillion fighting the war in Iraq we never should have fought. You invest $1 trillion in infrastructure, 13 million decent-paying jobs. Keystone Pipeline gives you 3,000 or 4,000 short-term construction jobs. What's better? Well, I think rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system. So I don't think that's a trade-off that I would make. I think doing the Keystones just sends a terrible signal to the whole world that we're not serious about climate change. But I will work as hard as I can. One of my top priorities is to find the money to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure and create the jobs that would take place.
We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders today. He's in the studio with us on a break from D.C. And listeners, if you have questions for him about his renewed focus on prescription drug prices, how his role will change in the new Senate in January, or his push to have more care for veterans suffering from mental health issues, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What do you want to ask the senator? You can also post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're joined in the studio by Bernie Sanders, who's back in Vermont for the Senate recess. He's been telling us about his views on the president's action on undocumented immigrants in the United States and what he thinks still needs to be done by Congress on immigration. And we've looked at his vote on the Keystone XL pipeline. If you have a question for him about his priorities in Washington, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Steve calling in from Westminster West. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Bernie and Jane. One of the lessons of the 2014 Democratic losses was that unlimited money as a result of Citizens United will result in basically bought elections and also voter suppression. But the other lesson, I believe, is that the Democrats lacked a message or a framing of the issues that was compelling to voters. And I'm just worried that the Democrats are going to move to the right after this disastrous election. And Bernie, I'd like your thoughts on that.
Hey, Steve, thank you very much for that excellent question. And I agree with every word that you said. You know, Jane, we can talk for 5 hours about every issue imaginable. But Steve, I think, hit the most important. And that is right now, in my view, and I don't mean to be overly rhetorical here, I worry very much that this country, our great nation, is moving toward an oligarchic form of society in which a handful of billionaire families will end up controlling the economic and political life of the nation. And one of the ways that that is happening, as Steve indicated, is this disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, which says to the billionaire families like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and others, that, hey, you can spend as much money as you want on campaigns. And we have seen the results of that. And I fear that what this last election was about and what will be worse in coming elections is that a family like the Koch brothers, who are worth $85 billion, can pour billions of dollars into elections. And then at the same time, as Steve also mentions, the Republicans are working very, very hard at voter suppression, making it harder for low-income people, older people, to participate in the political process. You add that together, billionaires buying elections, poor people unable to vote in elections, that's not really, to say the least, a democratic form of society. That's moving toward an oligarchy, and I worry about that very much. So people who are concerned about climate change, if you're concerned about health care, you're concerned about education, you're concerned about the economy, you must be concerned about campaign finance. My view is, and I'm going to work as hard as I can to make it happen, we have got to overturn through a constitutional amendment this Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, and we've got to move toward public funding of elections. In terms of the Democrats moving to the right, you know, I think, again, Steve, and not having a compelling message for the American people, I think Steve is right again. I think the issue that people want to hear discussed is that why is it, with a huge increase in productivity in the last 30 or 40 years, why is it that the average person, the person right in the middle of the economy, has seen his or her standard of living decline? Why is that person working longer hours for low wages? Why is that person struggling with health care? Why is that person really nervous about being able to send their kid to college? Why? Why is that happening? And the answer is that we have a war going on, in my view, by the billionaire class and corporate America against the needs of working families. These guys, and I'm not, this is the simple truth. They want to cut Social Security. They want to cut Medicare. They want to cut Medicaid. They want to cut education. They want to give more tax breaks to billionaires and large corporations. That is their agenda, and they have unlimited resources to implement that agenda. And I think the American people want members of Congress, elected officials, to stand up and say enough is enough. When the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%, when 95% of all new income is going to the top 1%, when the average person is struggling desperately to put food on the table and keep his or her head above water economically, the billionaire class cannot have it all. And we need an agenda to speak to the needs of working families and get them excited and involved in the political process. I will tell you that what is extraordinarily depressing to me is not only that in this last election we had the lowest national voter turnout since, I believe, 1942, but you have a situation where 80% of young people did not vote, and about an equal number of low-income workers. So what kind of democracy is it when the people who are the future of this country have given up and the people who are hurting the most economically don't vote? we have got to deal with those issues.
Well, you say that this is where you think the American public is. You say they want somebody to stand up and take this message to them. Is that why you're thinking of running for president, to test that message?
Well, I am thinking of running for president because, as I've just mentioned, I think there is a great deal of frustration and unhappiness in this country where the American dream, you know, my dad came to this country at the age of 17 without a nickel in his pocket. He never made any money, but he was able to send his two kids to college. For him, that was a pretty good deal. That dream is disappearing for millions of families. And you have an incredible amount of greed at the top 1%. You know, and it's not just the Koch brothers. It is the Business Roundtable. It is Wall Street. They come forward to Washington with an agenda. We want you to cut Social Security. We want you to cut Medicare. We want you to cut Medicaid. You know, we only made $25 million last year. That's not enough for us. The Koch brothers saw a $12 billion increase in their wealth in 1 year. Not enough for them. So I do believe that the American people understand that we are in the real danger of losing the middle class of this country, and that they want, you know, public officials, they want candidates to stand up and fight for them. So, yes, that is what I'm thinking about.
Well, while we're on this topic, let's go to Michael in Michigan. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
In Michigan.
You know, first, let's wait on Michael. It looks like he – there we go. Michael, you there?
How you doing? Bernie, I'm a 20-year-old Michigan State student. I've grown up in a world where we're stimulated by negative things such as greed, like you said, and I'm tired of it. You are basically my hero at this point. I follow you every day, and I basically, if I have one question for you, it would be, how can I spread your movement around for the next 2 years, increase awareness, and get the kids going? Because whenever I talk to people, I know that they, you know, kids are open-minded.
All right, so there's Michael. We're going to take one more, and then Senator Sanders will get your response to both of them. Steve is calling in from Los Angeles. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Sanders. It's Steve Stokes. I'm definitely very concerned about the state of our nation, as I'm sure you are. And I'm just, you know, we really need leadership at the top level, and I'm wondering where you stand on as far as either your own presidential campaign and or who else you might consider supporting, because we really need to get behind somebody who has the best interests of our country at heart.
All right. Steve and Michael, they're both calling in, listening to you here in Vermont, but calling in from out of state. You know, there seems to be a movement, at least, of people who are hoping that you will take this step and run for president.
Well, let me say to Michael in Michigan, thank you very much for the call. Young people, you know, by definition, are the future of this country. And as I said, it depresses me very much that 80% of them have given up on the political process in terms of the midterm election and not even voted. And these are people who are often graduating college deeply in debt. Some of their brothers and sisters, young people, can't even afford to go to college. They're wondering about what kind of jobs they're going to have when they get out of college. And Michael asks, what can he do? What I would say to Michael is we have got to do everything that we can to mobilize young people. We have to mobilize all people in this country to mobilize young people and tap their idealism for a better society. You know, when I was perhaps Michael's age, or maybe a little bit older, we were motivated by people like Martin Luther King Jr. and others who said that in America, we're not going to tolerate a segregated system. We're not going to tolerate apartheid in the United States of America. And millions of people, in one way or another, played a role in that struggle. The struggle of this moment, Michael, right now, is oligarchy. And whether or not we continue to tolerate a handful of arrogant, selfish, greedy billionaire families who want it all. And what we have got to do is make sure that young people understand. Just give you one example. In our country, and I speak to people in Vermont all the time about this, our young people are graduating on average something like $29,000 in debt. They graduate college, go to graduate school, talk to a young doctor. She graduated $300,000 in debt. If there are countries around the world where they do the smart thing, they say, we want young people to get an education. And tuition in their schools is zero. 50 years ago in America, tuition in great state universities like the University of California, State Colleges of Vermont, zero or almost zero. What happened over that 50-year period? Michael, we can mobilize people. It's a question of priorities. I'm on the budget committee. Do you give tax breaks to billionaires? Do you spend money, more money that you need on the military, or do you put it into education? And if we mobilized a few million young people, we can turn that around. In terms of Steve's question from Los Angeles, Steve, thanks very, very much. And you know, I think your point about people being worried about the future of this country, let me give you some examples. I mentioned education. 30 years ago, Jane, the United States had the highest percentage of college graduates in the world. All right, more of our people, higher percentage of our people graduated college than any other country in the world. Today, we are in 12th place. Some decades ago, we had the best infrastructure in the world. According to 60 Minutes last night, I think we are in 16th place or 12th place or something like that. We are the only major country on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all of its people. We have worse income and wealth inequality than any other major country on earth. That's the reality that we are dealing with today, and the American people are not happy about that. So I say to Steve, you know, whether it's, you know, running for president or whatnot, I am thinking about it. But what I am wondering about and you know, what I am hesitating about is when you take on the billionaire class, that's Wall Street, that's the military-industrial complex, that's the insurance companies, that's the drug companies, that's the Koch brothers who have all unlimited resources. Can they, in fact, be effectively engaged? Can we mobilize millions of people? So it's easy to give a speech, but it's a little bit harder to know what the reality is on the ground.
But you've been taking those on for years.
Yeah, well, it's one thing to do that in the state of Vermont, but it's another thing to know that, you know, that you are going to be up against an unprecedented onslaught of money that can start tomorrow. We're not talking about 30-second ads starting 6 months before an election. Their job is to destroy people personally. That is what their job is. That is what they do. They don't want to debate the issues. That's not what their politics is about.
So you're worried about how this, I mean, this could get very personal, you think?
Could get very personal?
Would get very personal, you think?
It would get. And it's not just me. It's anybody. That's what they do. They have nothing to say on the important issues facing America. So the way they win campaigns is they try to destroy opponents. But that's not even the concern. I could deal with that. But the real concern is there the appetite in this country? Are people so demoralized? Look, we have to deal with the reality. Maybe they won. Maybe they got it. And maybe they can't be beaten. That's simply possibly true. I certainly hope to God that is not the case. But whether or not we can mobilize the millions of people that we need to mount a strong grassroots effort in 50 states in this country, that's what I'm trying to ascertain.
We're talking to Senator Bernie Sanders today. We're talking about some of the issues he's thinking about in Washington, including, yes, whether or not he wants to make a run for president. If you have questions for him about some of the other things he's been working on in Washington, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or respond to what he just said. Go to VPR.net, click on Vermont Edition. You can let us know what you're thinking.
Jane, let me jump in here if I might.
Sure.
I would love to hear from people. And I hadn't realized that this program is going all over the country. That's what the internet does, huh?
That's right.
Can the billionaire class be defeated, or are they too powerful? What do people think? And are they prepared to try to engage in that struggle? You know, we heard from
Is that what it's going to take from you? Or are you just waiting to hear from people? I mean, what's
– Well, I'm just trying to – first of all, I want people's judgment. You know, it is right now I can tell you that the people who run this country have, you know, with Citizens United – and by the way, let me – you know, somebody called up about Citizens United. The Republicans want to go further. They think Citizens United did not go far enough. They want to end all campaign finance limitations, which means they want the Koch brothers to be able directly. Somebody wants to run for governor of Vermont? Here's a check for $10 million. That's Trump change for these guys. That's where they want to go. Can we beat them?
All right. We are talking with Senator Sanders. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to look at mental health care for veterans. We might have time to talk about prescription drug prices, some of the other issues that the senator is working on. And again, if you have a question for him, our number 1-800-639-2211. Or the senator has posed a question for you. Go to VPR.net, click on Vermont Edition and answer it. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders, who's here in the studio with me as Congress takes a break from Washington. If you have a question for him about the issues he's been voting on in the Senate or his priorities, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Maybe a safer bet to post your questions, post your thoughts, post your responses online at VPR.net. Senator, you recently held a hearing in the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee to address suicide prevention among military veterans. Valerie Pallotta, a Vermont mother whose son Joshua committed suicide, was among those who testified. What do you think needs to be done to improve care for veterans?
And I want to thank Valerie very much. She did a, you know, her grief is still very real. I think her son committed suicide several months ago, not a very long time ago. And she was just extraordinary, as was another panelist, Mrs. Selke, whose son committed suicide several years ago. There is a bill right now that we are working on that I hope we can get passed in the lame duck session, which would put a greater focus on mental health. The VA serves about 6.5 million people a year. Many of them are dealing with mental health issues and PTSD and TBI issues. But I think we need to make sure that we have the kind of psychiatrist and mental health counseling available to take care of that huge number of people, and I think we don't right now. So one of the things that we did in a recent bill is put $5 billion into the VA for them to go out and hire new physicians and mental health people and so forth. But I'm not sure that there should not be a greater emphasis on mental health. So that's one of the things we want to do. Second of all, there is existing legislation right now which says that if you served in Iraq and Afghanistan when you came back, regardless of your income, within the next 5 years after you're returning, you will get free VA health care. I want to see that extended to 10 years. And the reason for that is that PTSD doesn't simply pop up the day after somebody comes home. It could come up 7 years later or 8 years later. And we have folks from Vietnam who are still struggling with the issue. So I think it's important that we extend that opportunity for people to get into the VA for a 10-year period. And there are some other provisions in there. But bottom line is we are suicide, especially among young returnees, men and women, is much, much, much too high. It is a terrible issue, and we've got to do everything we can to prevent it.
Do you think culturally the military has come to a place where it recognizes mental health issues as a health issue and something that veterans and soldiers can get help for?
Jane, that's a great question. And the answer is I think both the Department of Defense and the VA are doing better at that, but I still think they have a long way to go. It's, you know, in a culture built on military strength and prowess, it is hard for some people in the military to understand that PTSD is as real an illness as the loss of an arm or a leg or other types of physical problems. So I think they are making progress, but I think they have a long way to go. And the other problem is that, you know, there are many young men and women who do not want to be labeled and worry about their future employment opportunities if somebody labels them as having mental issues, emotional issues. So it's an issue we are working on. I think we're making progress, but we've got to do more.
This morning we learned that Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel will be leaving after almost 2 years in that position. According to reports, his departure is a mutual decision between him and the president. But Politico reports that, quote, Obama and his inner circle never fully integrated Hagel into the decision-making process and did not hide their concerns about him. What's your reaction to Hagel's resignation?
Not much. I'm not aware of the inner workings between the administration and Hagel. I know Chuck, and I think he's done a reasonably good job.
Dustin wrote in to say, as a veteran, I thank Senator Sanders for his hard work on improving medical care for veterans. Another issue that affects vets is a lack of opportunity after service. Right. Often the GI Bill falls short and we have to apply for private student loans, which are catastrophically broken. My question is, has he thought about reform for education for veterans and for private student loans?
The answer is yes. We have made some progress. The post 9/11 GI Bill, while not perfect, has given, I believe, about 1 million veterans and people in their families the opportunity to get a higher education. That's nothing to sneeze at. As part of the recent bill that I helped getting passed, we dealt with an issue of in-state tuition where veterans who moved to another state would have to pay out-of-pocket cost to deal with higher tuitions in that given state. We addressed that. But he is absolutely right. As a nation, as I mentioned a moment ago, in a highly competitive global economy and at a time when so many of the jobs out there require a really strong education, we have got to understand that investing in education and making sure that our people, regardless of their income, can go to get a higher education and not leave school deeply in debt is a major, major priority.
Let's go to Jonathan calling in from Marlborough. Hi, Jonathan. Go ahead.
Hi, Bernie. I'm calling about our local post office. I don't know the whole story about it, but I'll just give you what I know. There's something about the union is requiring the clerk that we have, who we love, to work more hours than she can reasonably work. And the other thing is that no one wants to come up from the Brattleboro office, which is where they would have to come from, because of the reduced hours of our post office. And I know that this is something that you've dealt with quite a bit, but I just wanted you to know an individual case where it sounds to me like our post office is threatened.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. I will take a look at it. When I get back to the office, we will find out what's going on in Marlborough. The overview here, and I have played an active role in this, is that several years ago, the Postmaster General, who is retiring now, came up with a plan that would shut down 15,000 mostly rural post offices all over America and many, many of them in states like Vermont. And we fought that very hard as best we could. And what ended up happening, instead of shutting down 15,000 post offices, none of them were shut down, but hours were cut. In some cases from 8 to 6, in some cases from 8 to 4. I don't know what happened in Marlborough. And then if you're working 4 hours a day, that means that obviously the postmaster is going to earn less money and what happens there and so forth and so on. But I will check into Marlborough. We are right now, Jonathan, dealing with another issue, and I don't know if we're going to win this one. Post office wants to shut down 82 processing plants throughout the country. We fought very hard to maintain it successfully. The processing plant in White River Junction, hundreds of jobs there. But there is an effort on the part of Republicans and the postal leadership to basically cut, cut, cut. I think that is the wrong direction. The major problem facing the Postal Service is they have to pay $5.5 billion every year as a result of a decision made during the Bush administration for future health retirement benefits, an unprecedented burden.
Another issue that you've been very vocal on and active for many years is trying to make prescription drugs more affordable, especially for seniors, but for all people. You used to lead bus trips to Canada where seniors could get their medication, generic drugs, at a much cheaper cost. You recently held a new hearing on prescription drugs because you've discovered that generic drug prices are on the rise, sometimes significantly on the rise. Your new proposed legislation would actually require drug makers to pay a rebate to Medicaid when they raise prices at a rate that's greater than inflation. And that's currently in place for name brand drugs. Your legislation would put that in place for generic drugs as well. How much would that actually help?
Well, that would help save it would do two things. It would help save the federal government money, but it also sends a signal to the industry that they are being watched. And they cannot get away with these outrageous increases. People should understand, Jane, when you talk, I don't know what the adjective you use, large increases. We're not talking about a 10% increase. We're not talking about a 20% increase. In some cases, we're talking about a 500% increase, 1,000% increase. And the fear is it's not only a handful. We focused on 8 or 10 drugs. It is 10% of all generic drugs have seen very, very significant increases.
More than doubled.
Yes. And if that continues, then the benefits of generic drugs, which was a very successful effort to make sure that prescription drugs are affordable for working people, don't have to pay top dollar for the same drugs under a brand name, that benefit will be significantly lost. So we are going to stay on that issue. The three companies, we invited three companies to come. Not too surprisingly, none of them showed up to want to defend what they are doing. We're going to stay on that issue because in America, we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. 25% of the people who get prescriptions from their doctors, guess what? They don't fill them. Can you think how crazy that is? The doctor examines, says, this is what's wrong with you. Here's what I want you to do. It says, I can't afford to do it. That makes no sense at all. So we're going to stay on that issue.
But why are generic drugs on the increase in terms of prices? I mean, another company, the whole point with generic drugs, another company can come in and manufacture it under a different name, a generic name, that the patent is not held by
right.
that one specific company. So why aren't other companies coming in and making them cheaper, selling them cheaper, and taking that market
That's
share?
A good question. I think what we are seeing, and no one is quite sure of that, that you're asking the right question. I don't think – we had some experts up there who gave us some explanations. I think that there has been consolidation in the industry, fewer companies. And I think it is simply an instance where these guys think they can get away with it, and they are getting away with it. And that's why we want to call attention to it and do what we can legislatively to prevent them.
Is the question about monopolies and price fixing, though, because, I mean, drug companies are by and large private entities. They work on a corporate model. The way we've set up healthcare in this country, these drug companies are private companies, so they can charge, theoretically.
Well, they can't collude. They can. You're right. You're right. And that is a real problem. And the reason, by the way, that prescription drug costs in this country are far higher than any other country. The reason I took people over the Canadian border who in some cases were able to buy breast cancer drugs for one-tenth the price that they were being charged in the United States is because we're the only major country on earth that doesn't have a national health care program that negotiates drug prices with the company. So you're right. You can walk into the drugstore, prices can be double what it was yesterday. But what the what the Department of Justice is in fact doing is investigating whether or not there is collusion and price fixing.
Let's go to Tony calling in from Burlington. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call, Senator. Burlington, Vermont's got you back, and we're proud that you're out there representing us, at least in the Senate, and hopefully perhaps in the presidential run. Senator, on top of all the questions and all the problems that there are so many of, in my 58 years, the thing that has hurt me the most is that we've gone from dissatisfaction of our government to empathy in working with our government, to outright mistrust. I mean, Bernie, this is a government that can't even tell us who killed Lincoln, honestly. How, as a senator or as a prospective president, might you work to restore the trust that America needs to have in its government?
Tony, great question. And you're certainly right. There is a massive amount of mistrust. And there is a real also alienation of the American people for a variety of reasons, mistrust being one of them, from the political process. I think that elected officials and I think the media in general are not doing a terribly good job in laying out the problems, analyzing the problems and holding people accountable for solving those problems. For example, just give you one example about political consciousness in this country. According to several polls taken over the last year, some 63-65% of the American people can't even name the political party that controls the Senate and the political party that controls the House. So you can like Republicans or you can hate Republicans, you can like Democrats, hate Republicans, but how do you come up with a conclusion about who's doing what if you don't even know which party dominates each body?
So more civics in school?
Well, it's more civics, but it is for example, on a Sunday afternoon, you got half the country sitting in front of TV stations wondering whether the New England Patriots, you know, Tom Brady is going to do well. Everyone's analyzing the game. Well, you know what? Maybe we should be talking about why the middle class in this country is collapsing. People have different points of view. But, Tony, we need to engage. And if you've got any ideas, we work very hard on our website, sanders.senate.gov. As of today, to the best of my knowledge, we have 1 million people talking about us on Facebook who are talking about the posts that we send out. I want to do better. I want to figure out. I've held hundreds and hundreds of town meetings in the state of Vermont. Everybody comes. You know, I don't care what your politics are. So, Tony, the issue is how we lay out on the table what it's a serious discussion on the serious issues, respectfully hear different points of view, engage young people and working people in the political process, have people understand. You know, one of the things that bothers me, I go on sometimes this show or any show, throw them all out. Really? Doesn't matter what your point of view. No, they're all terrible. That doesn't make any sense. You don't like me? That's fine. But my point of view is different than somebody else's. We're trying to do different things. People have got to understand that. So, Tony, you've asked a great question. I wish I had a magical solution. But at the end of the day, we're going to have to educate. We're going to have to organize. We have to involve serious people in respectful conversations about the serious problems facing this country.
All right. Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks for taking the time today to be with us.
Thank you.
That will do it for today. We're out of time. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to switch gears. If you're worried about which wines to pair with your Thanksgiving feast, I can see Bernie Sanders rolling his eyes, but it's a concern for many Americans here as we approach the holidays. If you're worried about wine, we've got you covered. We'll have two wine experts on the show to answer your questions. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Don't forget, you can still talk about and to Bernie Sanders by going to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.